the Agile Revolution podcast. We're at the Agile 2017 conference in, where are we? Orlando, in Florida. All right, it's another hotel, another big conference. But really good to be here with David Bernstein. How are you doing, David?
I'm great, and it's great to be with you, Craig.
Very good. You're sitting in some inflatable chair, which...
it might rustle. It's super comfortable, though.
Yeah, it's really good. So, for people who don't know you, I mean, I'm just looking at your book here. You're the author of the awesome book, which I had the privilege of reading just a few years ago now. It's a couple years old. Beyond Legacy Code, which is a pragmatic programmer's book.
Yes.
But just well known in the community, I guess, for good software engineering practices, I guess, is probably the best way to explain it. So, for those who don't know you, what's the David Bernstein story?
What's my story? I don't know. I've been a developer for about 30 years, and, before the Agile world suffered. Suffered a lot. And as you can see, I don't have much hair up top here. And then I got introduced to Agile and technical practices, and life became a lot better. Mm-hmm. And once I got really convinced it was working for me, I started to share it with others, and it's working for them too. It's like, hey,
Extreme programming was your entry point?
You know what? It is. Actually, my entry point was design patterns.
Oh, okay. So that's the game.
Very much related to, yeah. But then I've been focusing on the extreme programming practices. It's amazing how these things that have been developed, years and years ago, I mean, even with the Agile or before the Agile movement, and it's really the solution, I think, in a lot of ways, because it allows us to build software iteratively.
Yeah, I think we sometimes forget with all the process and the practice and the collaboration and the communication and all those kind of things that at the end of the day, it was really all about software, right?
I like to say that Agile software development does have something to do with software development.
There you go. It's interesting, though, that even as programming languages get more, smart and a lot more people are doing configuration, I'm doing air quotes as I say that, over programming. It's kind of, as you look at the extreme programming, for example, it hasn't gone away. It just became, in my mind, what should be just good best practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we don't seem to talk about it as much anymore, which concerns me a little, because you all know, we were just talking about earlier, you go into many teams and the practices are still... sometimes, subpar to where they should be.
Not just sometimes, in my experience. And, occasionally they let me speak at, like, the Scrum gathering or whatever.
You don't like to talk about software coding there, are they?
I'm the only technical person that shows up there, usually. But there's a lot of people in the audience who really want that because, they're concerned with how do they build software. And so I ask people there, and even in my session here at this, I said, how many people are doing Agile or doing Scrum? Of course, everybody raises their hand. I say, okay, how many people are doing the extreme programming practices? Yesterday in my session, 6 people had their hands up.
Wow.
2 years ago when I was at the Scrum gathering, 3 people had their hands up. So, and most people look at me like, what's extreme programming?
It doubled.
Yeah, right, it doubled. Yeah. Hopefully we are on that exponential curve, but it's been still many, many years that it's people, and I don't fault them. I think it's great that they're doing the management practices and they do help, but the real value of Agile and the real value of Scrum is in the technical practices that enable us to be able to build iteratively. And if we ignore them, what we're going to do is just accumulate so much technical debt that in 4 or 5 years we'll not be able to do anything anymore.
So what do you think? Why people don't take this as seriously as they should? Because I think back to when I started my career, and I started in the mid 90s as a mainframe programmer, and the actual practices around that were actually pretty mature. Like the quality of the code, but then on the same token. We had one chance per day to check in and compile. And I think since technology's got a lot quicker and faster, and now we've got cloud and all those things, I can compile 1,000 times a day, and it's compiling on the fly. Do you think that's partly the reason that we've just sort of got a bit lazy in this thing, or maybe it hasn't become as important? Or I can't really put my finger on why this sort of lost traction, because extreme programming was kind of pretty big in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it's just beat off the radar to a certain extent.
Yeah, I'm not in all clear either, but I think it has a lot to do with the success of the Agile movement as well. I forget who it was, maybe Alvin Toffler, who said, the future is already here, but it's just not very well evenly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the truth. You know, we're we have Agile, but it's not very well distributed. And so people are doing pieces of it. And I think a lot of companies recognize, oh, I could do that. That's pretty easy. So they pick on those things. And, oh, that's a little harder, you know, those technical things. I don't understand those. So we'll just ignore them for now. I think that people generally go for the path of least resistance. And I think that there is a lot of information out there in the communities that are saying, oh, just do these management practices, just become certified, and, you know, then you'll all be all set. And it doesn't seem to be playing out. And I've worked with hundreds and hundreds of companies. I've seen this firsthand. I have lots of experience in the field. And what I see time and time again is that their companies are being consumed by their technical debt. And they don't even recognize it. A lot of managers feel it's people problem. Our developers are demotivated, or they don't care anymore, or whatever. And it's not that at all. It's that they can't get any work done because there's so much friction in the system. So remember, we are a really, really young industry. And in a situation in a young industry, nobody knows what the right thing is, you know? I mean, it's absurd to think that washing your hands before doing surgery would ever help anything unless you understand germ theory. Then it makes total sense, right? We don't have that theoretical understanding. And so everything that we do, all the actions that we say in extreme programming, to them sounds like washing your hands before you write code. What's that going to do for me? Nothing, right? Well, I'm not, by the way, I'm not suggesting you wash your hands before writing code to make it clean. No, that's not what I'm saying. Just want to be clear on that. But what I am saying is that a lot of the practices seem as nonsensical when we don't understand the principles behind them. So really, we need a two-pronged approach. We really need to understand what are the principles that drive really good quality code to make us go faster. And invariably, the teams that are going the fastest are the teams that pay attention to quality, not ignore it. The teams that are messing up, the teams that are feeling enormous amounts of pain and going over budget enormously, are the ones whose managers are saying, oh, just get it done quickly. Quick and dirty is not the solution. Now, it is in the physical world, so I understand, you know, there's a difference between a Pinto and a Mercedes-Benz. You know, there's a lot more energy put into building a Mercedes. And it's more expensive. But what is always cheaper in the virtual domain is quality, is always focusing on building something of good quality. And I don't mean overbuilding it, and I don't mean that developers are striving for perfection, because once we get out of school, we realize perfection is never going to happen. Most of the professional developers that I know, almost all of them, they're all concerned about doing the right thing. But very often, we get in our own way when we do it, or we'll try to do it. That's what we want to get out of. And honestly, the practices of, I say, if you're new, it's continuous integration makes the most painful thing in software development, which is integration in a waterfall environment, turns that incredible pain into our greatest asset as a software developer. Agile talks about feedback all the time. The most valuable form of feedback that I believe in Agile is the feedback I get from my build system, because I can run it and instantly know whether I caused some problem or not. And I can fix it so quickly that I didn't even notice I fixed it. Whereas if it was a defect that I get 3 weeks later from QA, it's the same exact defect. It takes me hours to get up to speed. It takes a long time. Hundreds of those kill a project. I can get through hundreds of those in a week and not even notice I did it when I'm doing test first development, and I get a good feedback from my build.
And I guess just leading on from your comment there about CI, I guess you're seeing what I'm seeing, which is I'm still surprised, and maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm really surprised by the number of organizations and teams who still don't have that in place. And this is a 20-year-old plus technology now.
Yes. Yes.
Mind you, I get surprised by some places I go to and don't have version control, but that's another story.
That really shocks me, right? But, you know, it's great to see this DevOps movement in the last few years, because I really feel like it's driving us to the compelling reasons. A lot of managers, and I fully agree with them, they're like, well, why do I really need to invest in quality when I could just put more memory on the developer's machine and then they can do their builds? And you know what? That's fine. I mean, there's a real valid justification for that. However, there are times when we run into a wall. And the wall that you'll run into when you take that approach is, I can't build faster, you know, because my build is now a 30-hour build and I can only run it occasionally. Whereas when you can run your builds so quickly that you get that instant feedback, that's really where value is.
Do you think... You mentioned the old adage of the surgeon washing the hands analogy that that again I also use quite a bit, but that's a professional field. So someone goes to university for however many years to become, you know, in the medical field, and then some more years as practice before they're even allowed, you know, in, you know, I guess, to perform surgery. In our field, actually, you can turn up without anything, right? You can teach yourself Swift and be a mobile developer.
Yep.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why we lack, I guess, professionalism or this craftsmanship in code?
Yeah.
Because there is no... And probably for good reason, right? Because I'm not entirely sure sitting through a 3-year degree is the best way to get to be a software developer. But because, yeah, we can, it doesn't really matter. I can go and teach myself, you know, programming in 24 hours and essentially get let loose.
So medical school is what? I mean, 3 to 5 years. I actually don't remember. But then there's a residency and, you know, there's a long process. But if you were in medical school and they taught you all about how to bloodlet and leeches and shaking rattles over patients and stuff like that, then you'd wind up coming out into the professional world as a doctor without the skills you need. You probably wouldn't even wash your hands before surgery. So I'm sure that if the medical world, and thank goodness it's not this way, but if it was, we would be like, who needs doctors? Well, that really is the case in the software world. The things that we learn in school are not things that we need to be able to build software iteratively. In fact, they're completely the opposite in a lot of ways.
But then how do we build that professionalism in then? Because one of the things that you do learn from going to university is, if nothing else, right, how to be a team member and how to...
Really? Did you ever take a course that helped you communicate better or interact better on
actually,
a team?
Actually, I did, but maybe I did the wrong degree, but...
I know engineering degrees in the United States, and I do believe it is better in outside of this country. And this is, by the way, our last stand in America. I mean, this is the thing that we do really well, software. And a lot of other countries are now in the position to do, which is awesome for them.
But it was just things like, you know, turning in a project on time, which is the same as turning in a, you know, report on time. Like,
sure.
It's just those things that you learn through there. But they don't equip you to, I guess, writing good code necessarily. Like, I think I had a 1-hour lecture on, you know, where they pulled out some book from the 1970s about, you know, how to structure curly braces. You know, like, that's all I remember. And bear in mind, it's been a few years since I've been at university. But
yeah.
I'm not suggesting university is the key. But how do we build this professionalism in? Because there's no body.
There's no peer reviewing. There's no residency. There's no support structure of any kind.
So if your first job is to land in a team of a bunch of cowboys, then that's what you know.
Yeah.
Or if you're just cutting code yourself, or if you...
Yeah.
So the only way you do get to know, and in fact, the only way I really got... The whole reason I got involved in, you know, the Extreme program was there was a very passionate person on the team who went, hey, I've just read this white book, you know, by this guy named Kent Beck, and I went, who? Right?
Uh-huh.
Give it a read, and... You know, sort of read through
it makes
that
sense.
And then I read the TDD book and went, this is pretty cool. And,
yes.
And you know, decided that actually we might get some value out of this. But I think if someone actually hadn't shown me where that stuff was, I wouldn't have known. So I wonder whether that's actually half our problem.
I think so. I think that we don't really know that there's a better way to do things, and that's why we do things the old way. There is a better way to do things.
Well, thank God someone's written a book about it.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the reasons that I wrote my book. My book is really...
He's holding out the book, by the way, which I know you all can't see because it's audio. But.
Of course. The title is a little bit misleading. Beyond Legacy Code is not really focusing on Legacy Code. It's how to get beyond it. It's about how to not get there in the first place.
So your code is always changing, always evolving.
Yeah, so it's flexible. And what are the practices that support us in doing that? That drop the cost of ownership for software, because that's really what it's about. Because it costs 5 times more to maintain code than it costs to originally write it. And that's just sort of overall. So if you think it's really expensive, if your team is like, wow, it's really expensive for our team to build this thing, you're only spending a small fraction of what you will spend if your software is successful. Well, then the other thing is that it's more likely that your software will not be successful. I don't know if in that context maybe that's good news, but it's not good news, is it? We want successful software and we want to keep the cost of the maintaining it down. And when I say maintaining it, I don't mean operations. This is an NAST study, and they found that the major costs are that it costs half as much to fix bugs that have been released into the field than it costs to build the thing initially, and that it costs twice as much to build it initially to make minor enhancements. I don't mean major overhauls, minor enhancements. And that's because we build unchangeable software. We think of software as a write once approach, and it's not. It's a really a write many. If your software is successful, people will want it to be changed. Your users will want new features, new changes to it.
And I guess our new paradigms and our new languages help with that a lot more than they did traditionally.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, you think about microservices, you think about some of the functional languages that are, that are now starting to flow out. They're more naturally written in a way that makes that a lot easier than our more procedural, even ROO type languages, I guess.
I hope people catch on to the functional paradigm because it seems like no one has caught on to the object-oriented paradigm. I look at hundreds and hundreds of projects across, my clients, and the vast majority of code that I see is procedural code with a class statement slapped around it. That's not what OO is about.
And so what do you think it is? Because people just don't understand object-oriented?
Yeah, it's very alien in a lot of ways to the way we think consciously. The way we think consciously is procedural, And so when a manager who doesn't understand development says, do it this way, and developers they comply, right? It's like our hands are tied behind our back. Okay, we'll do it that way. And it's not the best way to build it because, yes, it does the trick, but it also is highly unmaintainable. Everything's intertwined with everything else. That's how we think and how we communicate, but the world doesn't work like that. I'm sitting on a chair, but this chair is not welded to the floor. It will move. But our software is all intertwined and welded together, and we have to find ways to build it so it's independent. That's the intent of OO. Mm. But we don't use OO that way.
Yeah, which you would hope some things like writing microservices, for example, as just one approach. It doesn't matter which language you use, forcing you to write small things and interconnect them.
Yes.
Particularly, I guess, now that we can have something over here on the cloud to connect to something on a phone, to connect to something in a local workplace somewhere, which was really, I think, the plumbing was the hard part in the past.
Yes.
Yes. So in the book, you talk about a bunch of different different topics in there. So I wouldn't mind just getting your sort of opinion on a few of them in there. So TDD, right? That's a bit of a polarizing topic for some people. What's your stance on TDD? Is it a must do?
I'm a big believer in test first development. Yes. And, I know that there's this whole movement out there, the TDD is dead movement. And when I looked into it, I have to honestly say that their concerns are truly valid. And I've seen test-driven damage. I've seen people write really bad tests because, honestly, very few developers really understand how to write a good test. Well, how could they? Because no one showed them what a good test is. I mean, I'm sure I know I can't, paint the Mona Lisa or do brain surgery or anything because I've never been taught to do those things, And plus, I don't have the raw talent to do a lot of those things. So writing a good test is not that hard, but we have to understand what are the key characteristics. And so as far as I can tell from the studies that I've read, about 10% of the Agile and Scrum community are actually doing the extreme programming practices like TDD and, refactoring and stuff like that. About 10% of those
that's pretty low.
That's incredibly low, and it has sat there for several years now. Looking at the studies, the state of Scrum, state of Agile studies, year after year, what I notice is about 10% of those people, the ones who are actually doing the practices, are actually doing them correctly. And so the vast majority of people I see doing TDD are failing at it. Now, doing TDD, and I'm talking primarily Detroit-style TDD, the standard, the TDD Kent Beck introduced, and Ron Jeffries, and these people introduced to us. Primarily, it's really to help us with regression, to help us refactor our code safely.
Yeah.
But what I see is developers writing too many tests, writing implementation-dependent tests, and when they go to refactor their code, they find that refactoring their code takes a day, refactoring their test takes a week. So by the very definition of what we say TDD is for, if it's going to make it worse for you, and that's what is happening, then we're doing it wrong. Clearly, obviously.
With my tester hat on, though, my always, I sound like a broken record when I say it, but unit testing's never been optional. Right, it's always been a developer responsibility that if you're going to write some code, you have to do some basic level of testing to make sure that those units of code work correctly. And what I see, and I don't know whether you see this, is that
we don't.
Teams don't do unit testing. So what happens is then your test analysts, want a better term, end up doing the integration and the unit testing, and then user acceptance testing ends up being system testing, and then user acceptance is kind of just someone ticking a box at some point, whereas everyone's gone down a level. If the developers pick up TDD, even automate unit testing, as long as that happens, right, that's actually the first step. But test first is even better. Then everyone gets back to what they were supposed to be doing, right? System testers do behavioral, type testing, and then user acceptance is about making sure the flow works.
Right,
so
right.
This is this whole thing that units, I don't know whether you see this, but unit testing is not optional. Right? Where do developers think that they could get away with just shipping some code out and hoping for the best somewhere?
But you see, there's a lot of misnomers in the process. So even what I heard you say, if we take this approach, we're going to fail. Because we can't test units of code. When we start testing units of code, we start building implementation-dependent tests, and that's not going to help us in refactoring our code.
But that's not unit testing, right?
Unit testing, the term unit was adopted to indicate an independent piece of behavior. So we're trying to test behaviors, not units of code. And that's a very different mindset. Also, the mindset of testing is different from the mindset of creating code, of developing code. I wrote a book, obviously, and this is well known in the publishing industry, in the writing industry. There's actually a job for the people who edit your work, and they're called editors, and there's a lot of different kinds. And that's different than authors. When all of us have taken an English composition class, I'm sure, remember the first thing they told you, don't edit yourself as you're writing. Just let it flow, and then go back and edit yourself. Same thing in coding. Don't put your QA hat on, because as soon as you do, when you're doing TDD, you're going to be trying to say, what could go wrong, instead of trying to figure out how to make it right. It's a very different mindset, and they're mutually exclusive. Again, we need both, but not in the same person at the same time. When we do that, it's a recipe for failure. You're not helping when you do that, you're hurting.
But you answered my question there, though. That
yes.
What you're explaining there is, I'm thinking about unit testing, and I guess what I'm seeing is that somehow that job for a developer, or that role, has gone missing. That it's okay because I can compile. I'm compiling, every second, every time I change a line of code. Now the IDEs are so smart; they're compiling in real time. I've sort of lost this. I think people have lost this need that, we don't need to do that. It'll be okay.
So if you want to compile frequently, which is something we always want to do to check our syntax, wouldn't it be great if we could also check our logical interactions and stuff like that? That's what unit tests are for. They do that if you write them well.
So what about property-based testing then? Where do you sit on property-based testing?
What, you mean testing like getters and setters?
No, so your property-based testing is now this, new approach that's coming out of the functional community where essentially it's like a Monte Carlo simulation almost, where it's basically sending all sorts of random tests.
Again, this is not TDD and these are not developer tests. This is a QA test. And if you feel like you really need to do that in a QA environment, fine, but that is not what developers do. Developers create tests to articulate the behavior of a system so that they can generate that system, they can write that system. When you do TDD, you never put any code into your system that is not to make a failing test pass. And if you do that, then you're doing TDD correctly. There's other things you got to do as well, but you're on the right track for sure. So this is a very different form of test. We use the word test, but we're using it in a very different context than the QA testing or even acceptance testing.
So about refactoring then? What's your stance on that? Are you seeing people doing that effectively? Because I see a lot of these we need to go and spend three weeks refactoring, which is not my understanding of refactoring.
I think of refactoring at two levels. There's the refactoring that we do in the process of doing test first development. It's part of the steps. There's red green refactors. That's the cycle. But sometimes we need to do more than that because we learn in chunks. We learn in big increments, and we want to take that learning and put it back into the code base. And so every 3 months or so, we should do some refactoring as well. Jim Shore in his short and worded book, The Art of Agile Development, say spend at least 10% of your time refactoring. I work with the top teams in the world. They spend at least 30% of their time refactoring. And this is no coincidence. Top developers write really clean code, not in spite of the fact that they're fast, but they do it because it makes them fast. cutting corners actually slows us down. You know?
Yeah, I guess I think of, you know, the word refactoring very much more around, you know, the red-green refactor loop. So refactoring the small, you know, clean up small chunks.
Which is great.
It's almost rewriting when you're, you know, when you sort of look at something and go, hey, we need down tools for 3 weeks
No. What we're saying is we're going to refactor for 3 weeks, but we're never, ever going to be in the red for more than just a few seconds at a time. So
assuming you've got good coverage.
So, right, assuming you've done TDD correctly and you have good regression tests and you can run your tests all the time, don't be there for more than a couple of minutes in the red, because it's very unsafe, right? You don't know whether your system is buildable or not. And the further you go, the more things you're doing, the more things that could go wrong. And then when you do wind up in the red, it's like, well, what was the 50 things that I was doing that caused it? Top developers I know, the Arlo Belshis and Llewellyn Falcos and Jim Shores in the world, they run their tests on average about 3 times a minute.
Yeah.
And think of how powerful you could be as a software developer if you had that level of feedback. We always talk about feedback is so important in Agile. That's the most important feedback, the feedback from our build. And notice we took the thing that was the most painful, the integration stuff that we did at the end of a project, and now that we're doing it all the time, it becomes our biggest asset.
Absolutely.
Pretty cool.
I guess the other thing you talk about a lot in the book, besides the technical practices, is that it still has to tie back into the Agile ecosystem. So
yes.
You talk a lot about collaboration and breaking things down and those
yes.
things. Because those things we talk about in agility, you know, whether we call them tasks or stories is kind of irrelevant. What are you seeing there? Are we still doing that well?
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I kind of think of this book as explaining the importance and value of the technical practices to both developers and also non-developers. But I also, the first half of the book really addresses some of the challenges that we have and some of the process stuff as well. And that's also important. So the communication. The first practice in the book is, there's 9 practices in the book, and the first one is say what, why, and for whom before how. So this is really shifting the conversation with our product owner or whoever is our customer representative to really focus on tell me what you want and why you want it, rather than telling me how to build it. Right, and this is hard because we speak in terms of implementation. We speak in terms of procedural development. And what we have to do as developers is translate that into a functional world or into an object-oriented world where we can use the facilities of the language to give us maintainability, right? It's a very different way of thinking that only we developers really have. Everyone else has to talk about the what. We are the only ones who get to talk about the why.
Yeah.
Or the how.
Yeah.
It's fun for us.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's been a year or two since I've read the book, but I think the one thing that I took away from it was it almost explained why some of the things that your scrum master or coach might be saying to you, why that makes sense in a developer language. So, you know, like, so, yeah. So why are they making me talk about this story? Why are they making me finish this thing in 2 weeks? Why do I have to talk to the analyst or the tester in the first place? That to me was a real takeaway from this.
There, we live in these two worlds in the software development, the developer's world and then the world of the people around us who are supporting the development, the managers and the testers and everyone. And I really felt like it was time to write a book that helped bring us together and help us understand each other more.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you're speaking here at the conference.
I spoke at the conference yesterday.
Yes. So for those obviously listening, this will come out much after the conference.
Yes.
But so briefly, what were you speaking about?
The topic this year was on code quality, which is actually practice 5 from my book, Create Clean Code. And clean is my acronym for 5 key code quality characteristics that are quantifiable. I use the term quality, but they're really things that you can definitely see and improve in code. Cohesiveness, where your entity, your class, or your method is about one thing. Loosely coupled, it means that, you know, they're not bound together, not welded together. They're actually in a way that you could make them independent, so you could test them independently. Encapsulated means you're hiding how you do something and only showing what you're doing. A stands for assertiveness. It means that this, the behavior and the state go together. And N is non-redundant. So C-L-E-N, clean code. That's my acronym for way of understanding it. And just understanding that one thing, those 12 pages in that chapter, really help developers and non-developers understand key characteristics of good, maintainable software. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So you sort of brought up quality. That's still a challenge, I think, for lots of people, even outside development, but managers and leaders and those type of people. So what sort of message do you have to them about, because you've got to build quality in. It's very hard to build quality in later if you don't think about those attributes. So
yes.
What sort of advice do you have to people about having that conversation with their leaders?
Well, first we have to understand what quality means in a virtual world, and it means something very different than we understand it in the physical, tangible world. Once we understand what quality means in software, that it has, like, for example, that it is cohesive and loosely coupled and all those things that we were just talking about, that gives us the flexibility, the ability to independently test each piece on its own. If we see that as valuable, and it really it truly is, it is the key to everything, then we can focus on it. We can tell our developers, hey, this is something we're going to measure you by. Are you writing tests for your code? Are you writing it in such a way that you don't have to rewrite the code to test it? When you're doing tests first, you're always writing testable code. Mm. If you write your tests afterwards, you usually have to then rewrite your code to make it testable. So it's like double work. Mm. So when we understand that these things can give us benefits, then management gets on board, then developers get happy, and life gets good. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it turn around. Life doesn't have to be hell, and I really want people to know that. That's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm so passionate in the field, that I want you to know that there's a better way to do things. We finally discovered it,
So what sort of things are piquing your interest, sort of looking forward, like what sort of things are happening out in the agile development world?
Well, should mention the guy who just sat down and put his stuff down next to us, because he's the guy who really helped enlighten me 20 years ago.
And
Al Shalloway, yeah, and he really gets the technical stuff, mm-hmm. as well as the other stuff too. Yeah.
But are you seeing any
new ideas?
Any new ideas or your improvements?
Yes, I am. There's like the next generation. It's so cool. So like Arlo Belchi is someone who I think is definitely the next generation thought leader, and he's got some brilliant ideas that he always brings to the table. Troy McGinnis spoke this morning. Mm-hmm. He always blows my mind when he speaks.
And data and all that stuff.
Yeah, he's Australian too, isn't he? Yeah, and he's his ideas are just amazing. And he uses, estimation, which is like the crappiest thing in the world. He takes this idea and he brings it into a place where everyone can understand what the key conversation should be. So I think that's awesome. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, if people want to know more about you and where to find out more, where can they go?
Excellent. So my website and my company is called To Be Agile, and that's spelled T-O-B-E-A-G-I-L-E, like to be or not to be, but to be agile or not to be agile, right? So tobeagile.com is my website. My Twitter handle, if you'd like to get a hold of me, is To Be Agile. My book is called Beyond Legacy Code. You can find out more at beyondlegacycode.com. It'll take you to my Amazon page, or you can go to Pragmatic Programmer, my publisher, and get it. You can also reach me not only through Twitter, but through my website. And if you have questions or want to, work further with me, I'd love to talk to people.
Excellent. Yeah, well, I certainly know, we've got a lot of mutual friends in the industry.
Yes.
And it always is, what's the word I want to use? I say astounds, but that's not the word I want. Your name always pops up when people are talking about writing good quality code, or people that are engineering practices. Finding good coaches on engineering practices is really hard.
Yes, it is.
Your name always comes up in conversation.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I'm so glad.
So really, been really great spending time with you. I could speak with you for another hour or two, but
you've
got a lineup of people wanting to talk to you today. we finished the podcast with a simple little saying. If you'd like to join us, we say Viva La Revolution to finish off. So would you like to join me?
Oh, most definitely.
So we'll do it on the count of three.
Okay.
One, two, three.
Viva La Revolution.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.